Manufacturing,
and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members in Rayburn, Cooper, and Durham. Since 1988, businesses facing challenges have relied on the attorneys at Rayburn, Cooper, and Durham to find the way forward. More information at rcdlaw.net.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The New York Times recently reported that the United States is in the midst of the worst drug plague ever, with total overdose deaths now surpassing traffic fatalities. That same article cited Charlotte as a metropolis being capitalized on by Mexican drug cartels, delivering drugs in much the same way as pizza is delivered. The drug of choice here is most often heroin. It is highly addictive and relatively inexpensive. Local overdose statistics have been rising as this drug touches young and old, rich and poor. So this hour, we take a look at why Charlotte has become a popular distribution point, at what makes people crave heroin, at why it is so addictive, what is being done to help those who have become addicted, and what is being done to slow the flow of the drug to our area. Mindy Moralia has personal experience with this. She lost her son through his addiction to heroin and is now trying to warn others about the seductive nature of this dangerous drug. She's put her story and that of her son in a book, The Hero in Heroin, a mother and son's journey on both sides of the veil. And she joins us for the hour. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike.
Nice to have you here. She'll be signing that book on Thursday at Park Road Books from 7 until 9 p.m. Also with us is Dr. Christopher Lord, M.D., the medical director of the Dilworth Center for Chemical Dependency. And Charles Odell is back with us. He is the CEO of that organization, a nonprofit providing intensive outpatient treatment to chemically dependent individuals and their families. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Good morning. And because there is a law enforcement component to this, obviously, we've also invited CMPD Detective Brent Fouché, or Fouché, to be with us. Good morning. I made you French. Right off the bat here. Welcome to the program.
I do have some French heritage.
Well, I thought you might, given the spelling of your name. So how bad is the heroin trafficking problem here in Charlotte, Detective?
Well, there's no doubt. We have seen increases since 2003, 2004, steady increases. Probably around 2006, 2007, the turn with this black tar heroin, which is a different type of heroin. You referred to the sort of the pizza delivery method, I believe certainly made a difference. So we have been trending upwards since that time.
So is the trend going up because there are more people using? Is the trend going up because it's become easier to distribute? Is the trend going up because this black tar is more addictive and therefore there's more demand for it on a more constant basis?
It's more easily accessible because the distribution method changed. They'll essentially come to you, meet you in areas all over the city. So you're not just limited geographically to a certain point. You don't have to go very far to get it. There is black tar heroin. There is a difference in the chemical makeup and the processing of it, which makes it a bit more potent, sometimes less pure, but it is a bit more potent. And so the demographics have changed a bit there.
The New York Times reported that Charlotte is a major distribution point for this. Why? Why us?
Well, keep in mind, Charlotte is still considered a mid-level city, and a lot of times when this started, mid-level cities were good places to start up these types of enterprises. You don't have the large gang proponent. There's not a lot of you don't have a lot of competition. That's when it necessarily first started, and it just sort of grew from there. And remember, Charlotte's got to get to interstates. You got a major international airport. There's very easy access to Charlotte.
Dr. Lord, given the numbers of people that you treat for various forms of addiction, where does heroin addiction rank?
It's one of the most common. It's one of the more common, actually.
And you treat people from all walks of life, correct?
I do.
Why is that? Why is it the most common or the more common drug of all of these drugs?
Well, there was a perfect storm of things that occurred in the last 15 or so years. And It starts out with, I think, the medical education. I think it's not adequate for the number of people who have addiction, who see providers. I'm thinking back to my own medical school education, and I've given lectures in front of audiences where there was physicians in there and there were pharmacists and nurses, and they'll come up to me and say the same thing. They'll say, I didn't get much exposure to it. when I was in training.
So they're missing the addiction?
They're missing the training to either recognize it and then treat it, unfortunately. And that's how it just, you know, my generation and before, that was part of it. Another thing happened. So there was just not that much medical training to begin with. Secondly, something else happened. Around the end of 1990s, a drug maker for OxyContin began a really aggressive marketing to primary care providers, other people in treating what they call non-malignant pain, you know, non-cancer pain, non-life-ending pain with these medications. So that happened. There was a really aggressive push to market these medications. Another thing was happening at the same time. Very seasoned addiction providers, I mean, very seasoned addiction clinicians, these would have been counselors and the such, they were leaving the field in droves because of demands put on them by managed care to have certain levels of training, to have certificates. These guys were usually sober people themselves, and they had been, you know, they'd been educated that way. They might have had some degrees, but they didn't have the degrees that the managed care companies were requiring for them to be employed in these institutions. So they were leaving. They were not going to go back to school for that. Now, the vacuum was filled by individuals who were trained but not experienced. And so that is another thing that happened. So you have all of these things occurring at the same time.
Of course, the pushing of drugs by pharmaceutical companies for the relief of non-cancer pain, I don't think they intended for people to become hooked on these drugs, but that is the unintended consequence in many cases. And did they also not clamp down on how these drugs were prescribed? And so if you couldn't get the prescription drug, you could turn to an illicit drug and get it not only more easily, but cheaper.
Well, that's what I see happening, or that's what my patients have told me. That's the natural progression of things.
Yeah, I would agree, Mike. And, we see heroin addicts in treatment, obviously, and that's a good thing. They're showing up. But they, you know, the likelihood of ending up in a treatment program that will adequately treat your addiction is unfortunately dependent at times upon your entry point into the healthcare system. You know, if you broke your arm today, it probably wouldn't matter at which point you entered the system, whether it's your minor emergency or emergency room or primary care physician. Your arm would be treated equally as well in each area. But that's not true with addiction. The quality of care you get frequently depends upon your entry point and the knowledge of the person treating you at that entry point.
Is there also a component to addiction that is moral in its scope? In other words, people don't look at you seriously because you're just a druggie.
Well, I think that's always been there. I've been in the field of addictions treatment for 30 years, and I think it's gotten better as time has gone by. It's almost impossible to have a serious discussion about addiction anymore without focusing on the fact that it's a brain disease.
Hmm. Now, Mindy Moralia is here, and she has personal experience with this, and all during this conversation so far, you've been nodding vigorously at some of the things being said. Obviously, some of this you experienced in your life with your son, Micah.
All of it.
All of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did it start?
It started with him early addiction to marijuana, moving on into every other drug out there. And I would have to agree with Brent that probably around 2003 or 4 in our journey together is when he started doing heroin. Mm. I don't have an answer to that, but that's when I really knew we had a different journey ahead of us.
Did this happen in Charlotte or some other city?
Right here in Charlotte.
Mm. When they were talking about treatment and physicians not being able to recognize or not being trained properly to recognize the symptoms or what needs to be done as a result of recognizing those symptoms, did you experience that as well?
Yes, I did. I experienced that with facilities and also with certain law enforcement officials and courts here in Charlotte.
We're going to talk a lot about this. The New York Times says that we are in the middle of the worst drug plague ever. Is that simply because of illicit drugs like heroin, like cocaine, like marijuana? Or is it because, as you pointed out, Doctor, pharmaceutical companies, you cannot watch the evening news without watching car commercials and commercials for drugs? Is it because they're being pushed?
There's no easy answer. I mean, there's multiple things that are happening at the same time. I mean, our attitudes about them are changing. In addition, I mean,
we're getting more laissez-faire about it.
I think so.
And you know, also, Mike, I think it's always important to remember the contribution that alcohol has to this conversation as well. I mean, it could be said that there are more problems associated with alcohol use, misuse, and addiction than all the other drugs combined.
Well, you've said that, and I read that a comment is that you wrote that comment down, and I read it the other day, and I thought, well, then are we misusing this conversation? Should we be talking about alcohol and not heroin? Because it's far more widespread.
Well, I think it's probably appropriate to talk about all of it. I mean, you know, a lot of people don't view alcohol as a drug. You know, they see it as kind of like a beverage or, you know, certainly it's legal. And I'm not a prohibitionist, don't get me wrong. It's just that there's a certain percentage of people who drink who will become alcoholic, just as there are a certain percentage of people who use drugs who will become drug addicts.
Well, as an illustration of how our attitudes about all this are changing, there was a tiny little sidebar article in the New York Times Sunday magazine a couple of weeks ago called How to Roll a Joint. This is the New York Times. They're quoting this guy. He's 62 years old, and he teaches people how to roll joints. Which says what?
Well, obviously, it says there is a lessening of in some places
stigma is gone.
Less stigma, but you're also putting the government stamp of approval on some types of. This isn't a marijuana debate, but when you start the legalization starts, so there's a stamp of approval. But to sort of stay on point with where we are, keep in mind, to your alcohol point, it's really not close. The damage, the violence. Regards of alcohol deaths, if you put it in contextual of drugs overall, I don't think it's – alcohol is way above illegal drugs as far as violence and some of the damage. Would you guys agree?
Clarify that. I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Well, the alcohol is a legal drug, and it's the damage it causes through, whether it's through addiction – through violence attributed to alcohol, maybe.
Traffic accidents
in totality. Illegal drugs, I know a lot of people are against the drug war, but the drug war has, I believe, been successful in some ways of possibly, it's not as bad. Illegal drugs, the violence hasn't, I don't think, has gone to the levels of where alcohol has sent us in many regards. Mm-hmm. But going back to your point about marijuana, the lesson of the stigma with heroin, which is the point of where we are today. Remember, heroin is a physical and emotional, psychologically addictive drug. And so it's a very different animal in many respects from the other, drugs.
People have called marijuana the gateway drug. And you just said that your son became hooked on marijuana first and then progressed through other drugs toward heroin. And there is this lessening of attitudes about marijuana and this fight to decriminalize its possession and use. And in some states, they're allowing the sale of it for medicinal purposes. And we know that people who don't need it for medicinal purposes are having access to it. Our attitudes are changing. Should they change? Is it a gateway drug? Does it lead to heavier drug use?
I don't know that it leads to heavier drug use by itself. It is widely available. And so, therefore, easily had. Sometimes I'll speak to people, and they say they can find cannabis much more easier than they can find alcohol. These are underage people.
And what's the difference in the high that you get from cannabis versus heroin? And I have 20 seconds.
It's a remarkable difference, actually, and I can explain more when we come back.
Let's do that. Let's take a break and come back with more on that as well. Dr. Christopher Lord's with us, medical director of the Dilworth Center for Chemical Dependency, with Charles O'Dell, who's the CEO there. Detective Brent Fushi is with the CMPD, and Mindy Moralia has written a book about her son and their own personal journey through heroin. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Clayworks, a Charlotte home for ceramic arts and artists, now registering for beginner through advanced 8-week summer classes. Details at learnclay.com. eminentdomain.com. Eminent Domain, it's a tool that's been used for years by cities and states to appropriate private land for public use for things like roads and utility lines and rail lines. It has also been obviously quite controversial, but as cities and towns grow, the use of eminent domain threatens to increase, and state lawmakers have now proposed a plan designed to narrow the scope of that use, but critics say it may have the opposite effect. We search for the truth of all this tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, key provisions of the Patriot Act expire on Sunday. A new bill in Congress could change the NSA's bulk collection of phone records, what the proposed law means for domestic surveillance.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, talking about heroin use in Charlotte, which is a kind of a drug trafficking location for heroin, one of several around the country where a lot of heroin passes through, and the addiction rates and the overdose rates are rising. We were talking to Dr. Christopher Lord a moment ago, medical director of Dilworth Center for Chemical Dependency, about the difference in the high you get from marijuana versus heroin or versus cocaine or versus any other drug. What is the difference?
Well, I can tell you, and you can see this, it's manifest in the withdrawal symptoms that follow abruptly stopping the use. I mean, that's a good way of determining what the intoxication is. For instance, the intoxication from from opioids involves intense euphoria, analgesia, so there's no pain. People aren't hungry. They're not tired. It pretty much takes care of whatever is wrong with you at the moment. The withdrawal is the opposite of that, and it's awful. It's hideous. I don't have the right word for it. It's not going to kill you, but you will wish you were dead. Mm-hmm. It's awful. Mm-hmm. You hurt. I mean, I've heard patients tell me that I hurt to my bones. I hurt in my bones. Mm. They will feel crushing depression and anxiety. They can't sleep. They have diarrhea. Their noses run. They're crying.
And how long does that last?
It lasts it can last for days. If you're used to, we're talking about heroin. So that withdrawal usually lasts about 7 days, sometimes longer, and it hits a frightening crescendo around the third and fourth day, where most folks give in and end up using again. Wow. So it's awful. Now the withdrawal from cannabis is different. You may have some insomnia, you may have some anxiety, you may have some appetite changes. So it's a much, much more attenuated or lessened withdrawal phenomenon than it is for the opioids.
Your son took his life because he couldn't kick the habit.
Yes.
Couldn't kick the heroin habit. Had he tried to kick it? How many times did he try to?
I lost count, Mike. I can't tell you how many times. I know that in my journey with him, he said that there was nothing that he could not stop when he wanted to, operatively he, except heroin.
You believe that's true?
I can't tell you. It's not for me to be able to say other than what he said to me in this journey. And just as Dr. Lord just described in my book, mm-hmm. my son's writings appear in the third part, and he very graphically describes his experience of what Dr. Lord just described.
What does he say? Give us some examples.
In the book, he talks about kicking the habit and literally the body
kicks.
Kicking.
That's yes, where that phrase comes from.
Yes, it does. And he talks about being locked up, being locked in a place, in like a place where he can't get out. So he's
metaphorically speaking or really in a place? Where
no,
he can't
really
get
in a place, okay. In an institution,
right.
Okay? He writes about his precious medical moments. Here we go again. It's been years since my last confession. Fear and loathing in Oahu. So every one of these writings are about what it's like to be in addiction and specifically in heroin addiction.
Why did he write those things down?
Why did he write them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would have to say you might need to ask him that question, but I have a feeling because he was very expressive with his feelings and with his emotions. So the pen and the paper were where he did a lot of expressing that he couldn't do, perhaps verbally.
Some have said we live in a pill-popping culture, and we've already referenced the commercials you see on television. If you have a pain, there's a pill for that. If you have whatever you have, there's a pill for that, and it's on television. Is that leading to us changing our attitudes in general about drug use? I mean, if your mother takes OxyContin and Percocet and Vicodin, why shouldn't I use cocaine or heroin?
I feel we live in a society where people don't want to do the work to change whatever is making them uncomfortable. It's easier to take a pill than it is to change behaviors.
Something remarkable is happening. I'm a physician, I'm a doctor of medicine, I'm an allopathic provider. There's different schools of medical thought. I'm an allopathic provider, and that means essentially giving a medication to thwart a disease process. That's what it means to be an allopathic doctor. And you've probably seen a DO, doctor of osteopathy.
Yes.
And you've probably heard of homeopathy. These are different schools of medicine. So most of the doctors that you will meet are allopathic providers. So that's our philosophy. That's our way of thinking about people, okay, and their problems. So we have, we come largely, although not every doctor is like this. I mean, there's different examples all over the place. But just by and large, I mean, that's how we get our training. That's how we get our thinking. So, a weird thing has happened. We've been trained, and we've also trained our patients to ask for these things, okay? Attention concerns is a good example. I mean, I'm having problems with my attention and focus and concentration. I need some amphetamine salt. I need Ritalin. I need something for that, whether the problem is attention deficit disorder or not. So we train you, and you guys train us to, patients have those pull-out ads now, and then bring them to the doctor's office.
Yeah, but we don't take the Hippocratic Oath. You do.
Well, no argument. But there's a two-way street here. I mean, we provide it, and you ask for it, and that's what happens. Now, that's in a...
So has that changed attitudes about illicit drugs as well, or is there still a morality attachment to these drugs?
Well, I'm glad morality came into it because, it's inevitable in a discussion of, addictive behaviors. The disease component people, they sometimes miss the morality part of it, and there's people that, who view it as a choice only or strictly as a moral failing, and they miss the biological aspect of it. Addiction is complicated. People are complicated. And so sometimes these overly reductionistic views miss a key component of it. So there is a moral component to it, and there's always a moral component to a choice people make. But when someone's knee-deep in their addiction and they are withdrawing, and it's an intense withdrawal like the one you get from heroin, it's a forced choice whether I use or not. People, my patients will tell me, I didn't want to do it. I hated using it. I hated using it. I hated doing it. But the choice to not use at that moment for that person, knee-deep in addiction, the choice to not do it got a moment's airtime.
When does that choice become irrevocable? In other words, is it the first time you do heroin that you have to have the second dose, or is it the fifth time or the tenth time? When does it click in that you've got to keep going because it hurts too much not to?
It becomes very difficult to resist some weeks into it when your body has made the changes it takes to become tolerant and to exhibit withdrawal. It doesn't take long, on a matter of weeks.
Somebody called this a warm hug. The feeling that you get with heroin is a warm hug at first, and so you want it again.
Well, that's an interesting point, Mike. I've known many people through the years who have done heroin, some who have become addicted to it. I'm a native Charlatan. I know people who have died from it here in Charlotte. And, heroin and the other opioids have been around for a long time. And there's a reason why a lot of addicts who have tried it, once they try it, they don't do anything else. Mm. It's really the end of the road as far as euphoric substances go.
And yet, I understand, it is now really inexpensive. Cheaper than OxyContin, sometimes almost easier to get, but it's inexpensive. Why is it cheap? If it's such a great high and it's the end of the road and the pushers know it's the end of the road, why do they want to milk you for every dime you got before you go?
You're talking supply and demand. You're correct. Heroin actually stayed pretty static in its price for years and years and years. I worked in narcotics for over 20 years. It was the advent of the black tar heroin where the price structuring here in Charlotte started to change, and it became cheaper. You know, it used to be, it's now, you know, you may get a balloon for $10. It's cheaper. It's marketed great. The supply has increased.
And how many doses in a balloon? These are physical balloons.
Well, you can have a 1 gram balloon. You could have a half gram balloon. You can have a tenth of a gram balloon.
And is it true in these pizza delivery situations where they're not delivering pizza, they're actually delivering the heroin to you in balloons, that the people driving the cars to you to meet you to make the exchange have these balloons in their mouth so in case they're pulled over by police, they can swallow them? Is
correct.
That really what's going on?
That's been standard for many years. It was more popular in the West Coast, and it's drifted towards the East Coast since late 90s, 2000. And, yes, it is, because you defecate it out when you swallow it. And if you have to swallow it quick, it's a way of hiding it from police, and it's a way of keeping custody of it if you have it. If I can reach on one other thing,
sure.
When he was talking about the euphoria, I talked to a lot of lay people, and you know, I talked to a lot of addicts, and I've had more than one. Say, the first time I took heroin, this is it, I met God. And that's a quote from more than one person. And for your listeners out there, anybody who's ever been on morphine, if they can reflect on the feeling they got taking morphine, whether it was in hospital, when you take heroin, morphine basically walks up to your system if you take it legitimately. Heroin is like having a Porsche and driving that morphine to your brain. Mm-hmm. And that is that euphoric effect that you get. And that is why it's so incredibly hard to come back from it.
There are other opiate drugs. What is it about heroin that makes it so highly addictive and so quickly addictive and so highly pleasurable when you're on it?
The route of entry, it's intravenous, and you get that very quickly. The body pays attention when levels of things inside of it change rapidly. That's a real attention grabber for your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you inject something, it is automatic. I mean, you went from zero to a lot quickly, and your brain tells you so.
How fast do you come down? And when you come down, do you need, if you're a beginner at this, do you need the next
fix?
When does
withdrawal begin? Several times a day, every 3 or 6 hours, depending on how much you have. Sometimes, yeah. So heroin is a short-acting.
Is it almost instantly addictive? Well, I mean, if you take the first dose, are you likely to want the second? Right, as soon as possible?
Some people don't do well. Some people don't respond well to opioids.
Mm-hmm.
People are complicated, and everyone's different. Some people have really unpleasant experiences on opioids.
Mm. Across the country, the number of people abusing or who have become dependent on heroin has more than doubled in the last 10 years. One statistic says that heroin overdoses in Charlotte, including those that were not fatal, more than doubled in the last 2 years. That would be accurate? You see that?
Let's put that in context. In 2013, a new law was entered. Since 2012, yes, we have had higher instances of overdoses reported.
Mm-hmm.
But the important stat to look at how many deaths have we had. The deaths have stayed relatively static. Why is that? Why can overdoses increase so much? In 2013, North Carolina, I believe, was very proactive. They instituted a law. Which one of our problems was people not calling. You know, you would find an overdose victim by himself, and just nobody called. Now,
because of the legal consequences of it?
You're afraid of, who wouldn't be?
Right.
Who wouldn't be afraid of the legal consequences? It's a high consequence for possessing heroin. In 2013, North Carolina very proactively passed legislation. It was been termed the 911 assist law, where if you are assisting, calling to aid somebody, there's certain protections as far as not arresting you for if you have small amounts or drug paraphernalia. It's encouraging people to call when their friends or people have overdoses. And I think statistically we can show this is being affected by the fact that overdose reports go up, yes, but the deaths have stayed fairly static.
And when law enforcement or medic responds, does that drug that they can inject to reverse the effect of narcotics quickly work on a heroin situation?
It will, if they have it. If they have access to it, sure.
You've called this a biological disease with a choice component. Mm-hmm. Most diseases don't have a choice attached, so explain that to us.
Well, actually, most diseases do.
Really?
Obesity is a disease with a choice component to it. Diabetes is a disease with a choice component. I can be responsible for managing my diet and my sugars or not. I can make choices that make a healthy weight more likely or not.
Well, let's talk about the psychological part of this. If somebody's taking these drugs, whether they start with marijuana or they do cocaine at a party or they work their way up to heroin, something's missing. It's a craving that they have. Is it a physical craving that they have because it's physically built into their system, or is it something psychological that they're trying to fill the void with this drug with?
Mike, I'd like to interject just one comment on this. You know, true addiction really doesn't come in drugs. It comes in people. You know, one way to look at it is it's kind of like an allergy. I've got a kid who plays baseball, and he's got a friend on the team that – is allergic to peanuts, and nobody is allowed to bring peanuts to the ball field. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with peanuts. I can eat them all day long. I may gain a few pounds here or there, but I'm okay. The peanuts themselves are not the problem. It's the allergy associated with it that's the problem. Allergies come in people. True addiction can, on one level, be seen as an allergic reaction to the drug. Not everyone who drinks will become alcoholic. Not everyone who smokes pot will go on to use heroin. But for those people who had the allergic reaction, an obsession and compulsion to repeat the experience of intoxication comes up.
So what I'm hearing you say is it's not it is something in an individual. It's not psychological. It's physical.
Well, you know, people are complicated, as Dr. Lord says. I think everybody on the planet has issues, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suspect the day I'm going to be issue-free, I'll be life-free. And some people have psychological issues. Some people have physiological issues. Addiction comes into play, and it can compound whatever problems a person already has. It can also serve as a way in which to relieve some of the pressures associated with the problems that people may have if addiction works for them. You know, one other thing I'd like to make a point about, when addicts use drugs, they have a different reaction than normal people. And I've heard people say this over and over again who are in treatment. Addicts will say, you know, the first time I used the drug, my whole life changed. I felt as good, if not better, than I've ever felt before in my life. You know, most people don't feel that way when they use. I mean, my mother was not an alcoholic, but she liked to drink on a frequent basis. And when she drank too much, she would usually say, my goodness, I'm starting to feel it. I'd better quit. You know, it was a different reaction to her than, say, it was with an alcoholic who drinks and has this euphoric experience.
Is that what we mean by an addictive personality?
Well, perhaps. I think that's an oversimplistic term which, you know, may confuse people. I think in my view, the addictive personality comes after the onset of the addiction as opposed to before.
When we come back from the break, I want to talk to Mindy about Micah, her son, who died at 31, but he started using drugs at the age of 15. So let's go through that progression, because in relation to what was just said by Charles O'Dell here, we'll talk about that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNC system, offering over 100 flexible online programs in education to help you become a North Carolina teacher. Options at programs.northcarolina.edu. Key provisions of the Patriot Act expired yesterday at midnight. A new bill in Congress would change the NSA's bulk collection of phone records. And Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about what the proposed law means for domestic surveillance coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so right now. WFAE.org/CharlotteTalks will get you to us, or CharlotteTalks@WFAE.org, or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And I want to remind you that our guest Mindy Moralia will be signing her book at Park Road Books Thursday evening, 7 p.m. We're coming right back.
Gillian Flynn brings us characters we love to hate, like in her bestseller, Gone Girl. But for the Morning Edition Book Club, she chose an author with a different approach, Kate Atkinson.
She does this wonderful thing for her. She makes it very hard for you to solely dislike a character, even when they're doing very bad things.
The book is A God in Ruins by Kate Atkinson. Read it, and we'll talk about it on Morning Edition.
The Morning Edition Book Club, June 16th, starting at 5 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about heroin use and addiction and the fact that heroin trafficking in Charlotte is among the highest in the region and the country, with Detective Brent Fushi, who's with CMPD. Dr. Christopher Lord is the medical director of Dilworth Center for Chemical Dependency. Charles Odell is the CEO there. And Mindy Morali is the author of a book called The Hero in Heroin, A Mother and Son's Journey on Both Sides of the Veil. Your son Micah began experimenting with drugs at 15. Do you understand why? What drove him to it?
Only from reading his writings. And why he did it, I wish he never had, obviously. Mm-hmm. But according to his writings, it was at the coercion of a friend. Yeah, right, as he says.
Right.
In the neighborhood.
So he started with marijuana, and is that right?
Yes.
And he moved to what?
Progressively through everything that there is out there.
Marijuana,
alcohol, amphetamines, cocaine, pills, Xanax, you name it. Heroin.
How many times, when did you become aware of it?
I became aware of his drug usage probably when he was around 16 years old.
So he'd been doing it for about a year.
At least a year.
What led you to see the signs of it?
The behavior.
What changed?
The behavior changes. Actually, our whole family was falling apart mm-hmm. at that time. My spouse had left and had early onset of Alzheimer's, but we didn't know it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And my son spun off the other way with drugs. So he was oppositional, defiant.
Was that in response to his father leaving?
I feel it was a lot in response to the lack of his father's emotional connectivity
right.
to him.
And he couldn't because he was pre-Alzheimer's.
Exactly, and we didn't know that.
Didn't know it. So he went through the progression of drugs. How many times, when you became aware of it, what was your response? What was his response to your response?
My response as a mother was, I've got to figure this one out. I had no clue about addiction at all, period. Drugs never entered my mind.
Right.
But I had to learn. And I did about everything there was out there in terms of looking at myself in the mirror, my role of being a codependent, trying to take care of everybody, doing 12-step programs, seeing counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, learning all I could.
How many times did he try to stop using drugs? Not just heroin, but just drugs.
Numerous. More than I can really count over those 15 to 16 years. And he did have periods of sobriety. He did have periods after he had done heroin where he would be clean 9 months to a year.
What drove him back to it?
I can't answer that. We always talked about that. I always was honest and said, can you please let's talk about what might be a trigger. And over time, he ultimately said to me, you know, Mom, I just can't tell you what a trigger is. I can just be driving down the street and pass a place where I used to get heroin, and it makes me want it again.
That raises a question, because a lot of guys who served in the military in Vietnam and even to a certain degree in World War II were addicted to drugs, and I think heroin was a problem during Vietnam for a lot of people. When they came back home, their addictive response changed. How important is change of place? In other words, if a trigger for him was driving past a place where he used to buy drugs and he suddenly got the craving again, if he had moved to California, would that have gone away?
No.
No.
No. As a mom, changing places, moving him or moving around did not change that desire.
How quickly did he get into heroin from the initial dalliance with marijuana?
If I had to guess, I would say early 2000s, 2003, 2004. So half of his time in dealing with addiction over a 15-year period, I'd say at least 7 to 8 years is when the heroin, the last 7 to 8.
And he says in the book, he just couldn't stop.
Yes.
He tried, and he would always go back to it.
Yes.
He just could not stop.
Is
there something about him, doctor, or something about the drug? Because people have said that once you get hooked on it, you are on the path to death.
I know one thing that he used to do, and he told me this. He would try to take himself off of doing heroin by using cocaine. And I don't know how that works physiologically,
right. But
he would try to wean himself off using another drug.
You know, Mike, it's a hard question, and it's a complicated topic. The answer is usually both and instead of either or. So it's the drug and the person. When a person achieves some kind of durable recovery, and that's the durable recovery is I'm going to be sober. I'm going to wake up sober the next day, more or less, despite whatever goes on that day. You've achieved some recovery. If a person relapses, a few things have probably happened. One, they had a co-occurring mental health concern that either went unaddressed or inadequately addressed. They might have some toxic, unsupportive elements in their environment. You know,
right.
And they didn't tend to these things. That's what happens to a person with, you know, drug and alcohol concerns. Those are the things that kind of get them.
One of the problems, I think, with all these addictions is that the person who needs the help doesn't seek it because they're in the euphoria or the cloud of their addiction. And that leads to the death of people who have heroin because they don't seek treatment. How do most people come to you? Are they sent to you by loved ones? Are they sent to you because of interventions, because CMPD or other law enforcement have said, you need to help this person? How do they come to you?
You know, all of the above, Mike. I mean, most of the referrals we get are from other health care providers, perhaps parents, teachers, law enforcement. I mean, they come from everywhere. A lot of people just call up their insurance company and say, who's in the network? And they'll come to you that way. But, I mean, we've witnessed a surge in treatment demand over the past couple of years to the extent that the Dilworth Center is now embarking upon an expansion so that we can double our capacity to provide care. And this is as a result of demand. It's clear and present.
Mm. Many of those people who become addicted don't die from an overdose, but from opportunistic diseases, infections, accidents, criminal activity, hepatitis C, HIV, etc., from shared needles. Your son took his own life.
Yes.
Any signs that led to that moment in time? And I'm very sorry for that, by the way, but any signs that led to it? Any way you could have prevented it? Anybody could have prevented it?
I would say no. Throughout his life of addiction, he would write a lot about suicide. He wrote a lot about the only way he would be out of this is putting a gun in his mouth. And knowing him as a person and as the soul that he was, no one ever thought he would ever take his own life. So we were all stunned. As many times as he had overdosed and come back, he was like a cat with 9 lives. So to actually take his own life really said to me how bad it had gotten for him.
Help us to understand this, because you know, if you're in such pain that you're willing to take your own life, and the pain, and you know the pain is a direct result of your using a drug and you can't kick it, why not just take another dose and take the pain away? Why kill yourself? Doctor?
You know, it's a hard question, and it's not really possible to answer. Don't know what was happening to this young man at the time he did that. People are complicated, and behavior is unpredictable, although it's the thing we're supposed to do is predict what happens. I've seen people who have intensely, you know, toxic stressors in their life, and you wonder what, I mean, they're not suicidal. And you just, you know, and some people who have, by other people's perceptions, less toxic stressors and who are intensely suicidal. So it's an individual thing, notoriously hard to predict. And, you know, there's always a set of factors at any given moment where that either promote someone attempting suicide or prevent it.
One of the things that has made this heroin epidemic increase is its availability. And let's talk about Charlotte's connection to these Mexican drug cartels who see this as a hot distribution point for heroin. Their method, as I've said, has been compared to pizza delivery. How does that system work?
Essentially, they'll have a list of numbers that the addict or the user will have a number.
How do you get the number?
Through friends, through associates. I don't know how your son did it, but it's usually through associates. They will get the number. Some people are very protective of their source's number, so they'll charge up to $100, $200 to give someone the number. At which time, you just call and the person will take your order, and boom, they'll tell you where to go. And then you just meet them in some parking lot or some back neighborhood.
So you no longer have to go to some sketchy neighborhood where, when it's dark and you could be killed to buy these drugs. It's much safer?
It is. You usually commonalities are along major highways throughout Charlotte. There's no one particular
Are the drivers the actual pushers, or are they just working for the...
It could have, you know, you could be talking to the driver. You could be talking to someone in California who's dispatching someone in North Carolina, the way phones work, you know, nowadays.
So it's like Uber for drugs.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And then they'll take your order. Like sometimes you are talking to the driver, sometimes you're not.
Mm-hmm. Is CMPD aware of who's driving, where these things happen most often? How aware is law enforcement of what's happening and where it's happening and who's doing it?
I give CMPD credit. CMPD's, I think, in many ways been above, ahead of the curve. We've known about black tar heroin since the late 90s, early 2000s. We've proactively addressed the situation. I think we've been creative working with centers like McLeod Center, some of the local centers. We have proactively investigated both the powder heroin and also the tar heroin. So I think CMPD is very familiar with the organizations.
Have you arrested the drivers? Do you arrest if you're aware of a thing going down? Do you arrest the driver? Do you arrest the person buying the drug? What happens?
You try and arrest the driver. You try and arrest the source. If it's coming from a house, you try and locate maybe where they'll pick up. It's different. Different organizations or different sellers operate in different means. The one commonality is that they'll use this pizza method, as you have said, to distribute. And in a couple weeks, some of the difficulties are in a couple weeks, they may decide to change their number. If they change their number, they'll call everybody. So they have 50 customers.
Mm-hmm.
They'll call each of those customers, say, hey, this is my new number. They will also, every now and then, you will get a phone call saying, hey, are my drivers being nice to you? Do you like my product? It is very customer service friendly. I think if major businesses did that.
I think they're coming after us. Let's see here. Let's just share some emails that have come across the transom here. Athena emails, my daughter is in recovery from heroin addiction. When she was actively using, I handed CMPD officers numerous times the name, address, and phone numbers of her dealers. CMPD chose to do nothing about this, and these heroin dealers are thriving today. That, as you might imagine, is incredibly frustrating to me.
It's frustrating to us also. We do get complaints. Let me tell you, we do follow up on complaints. CMPD sends narcotics, sends officers to each and every overdose death. We attempt to follow up on the deaths, locate sources. I think in any city you will have you have numerous drug complaints, and we answer each everyone as we can.
According to Fox 46 News, Ardrey Kell High School in South Charlotte is one of the hottest schools for heroin in the region. I don't know whether that means heroin sales, heroin use. I don't know what that means. Is that true, do you think? Is CMPD aware of that?
CMPD is very aware of changing demographics. I don't have specific information on specific schools. Keep in mind, when the demographics of heroin sales and usage changed with the influx of the black tar heroin, as it became easier, as it became distributed into more into wealthier neighborhoods, from middle class to upper middle class, your demographics change. So obviously there are more of your middle class, upper middle class kids using it right now. It's become, as your son, it became a popular thing within the social group. From what I heard, and this is a commonality that we also see.
People use alcohol and marijuana recreationally, and many people don't get hooked. They just, as your mother, Mr. Adele, that she liked to drink, but she wasn't an alcoholic. She knew when to stop. Can you use heroin recreationally?
You know, I guess the question is, can you use it without significant consequence?
Yes,
and it's possible.
That's an unfortunate answer.
It's scary. Well, very scary.
It's unlikely. You know, my mother would never try heroin. And the reason she wouldn't I can't speak for her, but she's scared of it. She has no reason to try. Usually people who try it are people who are already attracted to the highs that other drugs provide, so they're less scared of it. These folks arguably could be addicts before they even head into using heroin.
Jane emails, Maryland's governor recently set up a heroin and opioid emergency task force to address the prevention and treatment of addiction and find ways to stop the flow of cheap, highly potent heroin into the state of Maryland. We need this now. Anne on Facebook says, a friend confidentially shared with me her son's addiction. Is there something that friends can do to support families who are facing this crisis? Very quickly, anybody have an answer to that? Okay.
Be there to support them.
Just be there for them.
Be there for them.
And don't